this country of ours, it's been torn asunder. Can it survive? I really wonder, with people choosing sides, finding no common ground. Compassion is weeping, but we can't hear a sound. We've got to come together and turn things around. So I'll tell you over and over and over again, my friends, we've got to walk that long road to reconciliation. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? This country is weak when it stands divided. Our nation's reputation has been derided. We've got to find a way to get reunited. So I'll tell you over and over and over again, my friend, to walk that long path of reconciliation. Well, I'm so tired of the hype and the hate. Is this any way to make America great? The twisting of the truth, it's gone unregulated. The healing that's needed can't be legislated. When human respect has disintegrated, it seems Lady Liberty has been suffocated. But I'll tell you over and over and over again, my friends, we've got to walk that long path of reconciliation. Yeah, we've got to take the high road to reconciliation.
Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Hendricks County. We are a progressive congregation of people of many beliefs, some with a religious background, some with none. Some who believe in a God, some who don't. Our beliefs are diverse but inclusive. We have no shared creed, but instead a shared covenant, including our seven principles, which you'll find posted on the wall back there under the clock, as well as downstairs. Whatever your faith, whomever you love, you're welcome. We welcome you here with all of your truths and all of your doubts, with your worries and your hopes. We're a community that embraces freedom of thought, where people come together to encourage each other to spiritual growth that makes for peace, ethical living, and community service. During Ms. Chautauqua sessions, a collection plate will not be passed, but donations are graciously accepted. Donations plates are located on the back table here by the door, and there's another plate next to the door on the way to the fellowship hall, where there will be refreshments afterwards. If you have any questions about our church, feel free to explore the literature that you'll find on the tables here, or ask any of us who are wearing a name tag. We'd be glad to try to help you out. With this, I would like to now introduce Bill Harrington, who will be moderator for tonight's session.
Boy, is it refreshing to be among friends. My name is Bill Harrington, and Phil Gully was kind enough to ask me to moderate. I'm not sure exactly what it means. He said something about a Kevlar vest, so I am fully prepared for whatever may come tonight. But I must say, in scanning the room, that I'm not feeling too threatened. And that's a fresh thing to say in America today now, isn't it? I'm going to let Phil explain to you what a Hendricks County Chautauqua is. But I know of no more welcoming place for this series to be conducted, and certainly for it to begin, than here at the UU Community Church of Hendricks County. Always a place of love and fresh thought and open hearts, and that's exactly what we need now. This is the first of 10 events that will occur every other Sunday at 6:30 here at the Unitarian Universalist Community Church. There will be different speakers. It's not just going to be Phil all the time, but that would be okay if it was. And so please mark your calendar for every other Sunday until we get done. And who knows, when we get done, we may decide to just keep doing it because it's the only place where we feel happy. So with that said, if there's one person that I know who requires no introduction, and you wouldn't be here if you didn't already know who he was, I welcome Phil Gully.
Well, good evening. Good evening. When we started talking about having a Chautauqua, Sam and I were talking about it, and I said, you know, Sam, we need to get somebody involved in this who's different from us. And so Bill had hair. And so we asked Bill, but you'll be pleased to know that in the next 9 sessions together, we're going to have people who are very different from us. We're going to have Myra Selby, the first African-American and the first woman to serve on the Indiana Supreme Court. Malcolm Byrd, who is Jewish and is an advocate for peace and works against talks about and deals with issues of Zionism and the problems that causes not only in Israel today, but also in America. Jim Mulholland will be here to talk about reparations. Jim is a white man, but has a African-American daughter. And so he'll be talking about reparations and the role of white people in issues of justice. So there'll be a variety of speakers, all of whom we look forward to hearing from. This is nice for me to be here because, of course, I grew up in Danville, down on Broadway Street, and the largest field in our neighborhood sat between the Corbett's house and the Land's house, where Broadway Street curved and began its 8-block run to the west. And the field was owned by the Davises. Mrs. Davis taught 4th grade and never knew a moment's peace since we congregated in her field, which was also her front yard, every day after school. And I don't recall that we ever asked permission to do that. We just showed up. Property rights were a lot more fuzzy back then. And so long as you didn't break anything or say cuss words out loud, you could pretty much play wherever you wished. It might have been our first exercise in civil dialogue, playing in Mrs. Davis's front yard. Later, when I began taking an interest in local history and spending time talking with Betty Bartley at the Republican newspaper, I learned that local young men mustered and trained in that field before marching off to fight in the Civil War. A few decades later, the first Danville Chautauqua was held in that same field, which thousands of people attended to hear lectures about science, history, and culture. They enjoyed music, listened to operas, endured political speeches, and sat through sermons given by well-known preachers and local pastors who had encouraged their congregants to attend. In fact, that was the genesis of the Chautauqua movement that was sweeping America then. It was begun by churches wanting to educate their Sunday school teachers. Danville's annual Chautauqua was such a success that when the residents of that street wanted to change their name from South Street to something a bit more prestigious, they almost named it Chautauqua Street until they realized no one knew how to spell it and so called it Broadway Street instead. That era became known as the Golden Age of Oration and included well-known speakers like William Jennings Bryan, who would later become the fundamentalist darling when he defended creationism at the Scopes trial in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925, just before he died. But the golden age of oration also included Colonel Robert Ingersoll, a veteran of the Civil War and Illinois Secretary of State, who spoke so powerfully and persuasively that when he would lecture on a Saturday night, telling his audience why he did not believe in God, it was said that the next morning the churches in those cities would be empty. This, as you can imagine, did not go over well with the local ministers, who began showing up at his home and picketing them, which he delighted in. And if he was busy, he would often send his daughters outside to debate them. Robert Ingersoll is so compelling that I once gave a sermon series on his speeches, and they were so persuasive that two members of my Quaker meeting became atheists and left. The first Chautauqua was held in 1874 in the town of Chautauqua, New York, in New York State, Western New York State, lending its name to this phenomena that would eventually sweep the nation. The town was situated on a lake that had been named by the Native Americans Chautauqua, which in their parlance simply meant bag tied in the middle. And if you go home and Google Chautauqua on the satellite, you will indeed see that it is a bag tied in the middle, a lake that is constricted in the center, and hence the name Chautauqua. The original Chautauqua remains. It began in 1874 and remains vigorous after all these years, after nearly 150 years. In fact, my wife and I will be traveling there this summer, where I will address the most perplexing of questions. How can evil exist if God is loving? Though humankind has been wrestling with that question for thousands of years, I only have until July to figure out the answer. So I'm going to be busy. This is all to say that for the first time in almost 100 years, Hendricks County has rediscovered the Chautauqua, has rediscovered the value of gathering on evenings to think and discuss and learn and grow. It is right that we should do this here in Danville, in the center of our county, in the oldest church building in Danville, built in 1884 in the infancy of the Chautauqua movement, at the heart of our town, the center of our county. I am here not because I am the wisest among us, a fact that will become painfully obvious to you in the weeks ahead, but because I believe that if you want a trend to begin and no one else is doing it, then you should, provided there are willing Unitarian Universalists to help. Jump right in. I became a pastor much the same way when in 1980 an elderly Quaker woman named Annis Carter told me I should be a Quaker pastor. And when I told her I didn't feel called to do that, she said, "A calling is when you see something that needs done, so you do it." So here we are. I should note that several years later, after I'd gone to school and gotten my bachelor's and master's degree and came back to that Quaker congregation to give my first sermon, Annis approached me afterwards and said, "Perhaps I was mistaken." Perhaps she was. Time will tell. Our theme for this summer's Chautauqua is Civil Chats on American Greatness. American greatness being an oft-mentioned phrase these days, with wildly different interpretations about what that greatness looks like and how it might be achieved. We hope in this Chautauqua to consider the characteristics that make for national greatness. Perhaps we might even call it a counter-narrative to what has gone forth so far. This is my list of characteristics, some of which we'll be covering in the months ahead. We're leaving it to the speakers to pick and identify the one virtue that they would elevate in our quest for greatness. I would urge you during this time to come up with your own list of qualities that you think would contribute to national well-being. But these are mine. If America were great, racial and gender disparities would be acknowledged and addressed. If America were great, those who can would help those who can't, while holding accountable those who won't. If America were great, ethical alliances, commitments, treaties, and promises would be made and honored. If America were great, it would be defined by its character, not its borders. If America were great, noble principles would become national priorities. If America were great, its citizens would live fully in the present and prepare wisely for the future. If America were great, its citizens would pursue happiness without infringing upon the happiness of others. If America were great, its leaders would nurture cultures and climates of peace. If America were great, its leadership would be representative of its populace. As I said, these are mine, but I won't be the only one speaking. Others will discuss the virtues they believe to be essential to American greatness. Before we cover some of those topics in the upcoming week, I thought it would be helpful to start by thinking about civil dialogue itself and the qualities central to civility. This is especially important because it is increasingly obvious in this age of social media, talk radio, and reality TV that our willingness to engage one another with thoughtfulness and civility has been compromised. Today, we mistake volume for truth. If something is shouted often enough and loud enough, it must be true. We confuse passion for fact. If something is felt deeply enough, it must be right. Dialogue and debate have become blood sports, a clenched fist grabbing for the throat. If this conduct were limited to one mindset, one party, one worldview, we could rally all thoughtful people to oppose this extremism. But unfortunately, this cancer of conversation has metastasized. The malignancy has spread. The right dishing it out, the left giving as good as they got. Full disclosure, I lean toward the left. I haven't always. The first time I could vote for a president, I voted for George H.W. Bush in the primary and Ronald Reagan in the general election, mostly because I was still living at home and suspected my father would boot me out of the house if he learned I had voted for a Democrat, but also because I was entranced by Ronald Reagan's vision of a city on a hill. Never underestimate the power of a good metaphor. At the time, I thought Reagan made up that image, but later realized he copied it from Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew, as in, a city on a hill cannot be hid. My worldview became liberalized when I attended college to major in theology, took a required course in sociology, found it fascinating, so majored in that too, and learned that societies and nations aren't born in the mind of God, which I had always been taught, that in fact nations and societies do not descend from heaven intact. Instead, they are human constructions shaped by humans and can therefore be changed by humans. There is nothing inevitable about the way we live together. Nothing written in stone, no infallible guiding document, no divine mandate that must be followed or else. There are only humans, some of whom act nobly and wisely, and some who don't. some who care deeply about others, and some who don't. And sometimes we are fortunate to have the noble, wise, and caring people lead us, and sometimes we are led by the thoughtless, the foolish, the selfish. It has always been so. It will always be so. In the midst of our American experiment, we sometimes find ourselves at odds with one another, pulled apart by differing philosophies, religions, priorities, nationalities, and economies, to name a few. These differences, if they are to be peaceably accommodated, demand our ability to engage, converse, negotiate, and cooperate with one another. These differences require what I will call a type of bilingual aptitude. Our first language allows us to speak to those most like us. This is the first language we learn as humans, the ability to speak with those who are most like us. And most of us master that language early on in our lives. We can talk with people like ourselves, people who think like us, who live like us, who look like us, who vote like us, and worship like us. We can talk with people most like us all day long. It is our instinctive, inherent language. But a second language is required of us, a language that allows us to speak with and understand those people least like us. And this is the language of civility. The language of civility, and it is a learned language. It is a complex language, difficult to learn, which is why some people can live their entire lives and never speak it. And we know such people. I suspect most of the people who haven't learned the language of civility have convinced themselves they don't need to learn it, which is the exact same reason I've never learned Esperanto. But here's what happens. When one examines the lives of people who have never learned the language of civility, here's what we see. We notice that their family life, their work life, their community life, when their emotional well-being, it is usually obvious that they should have learned that language, and that the language of civility is a dialect we should all master. Here are its characteristics. Now, this is not an exhaustive list. I'm sure there are other qualities I haven't considered, but we have to start somewhere. So here's what I think are, at least for me, the basic requirements of civil language. First, the language of civility asserts the worth of each person. This is the first lesson, the see spot run part, the starting point, the worth of each person. Because in incivility always begins, always has its start when the worth of others is denied. Incivility always begins with the denigration of the other, the fear of the other, that the other is the danger, and that's how it always begins. We first convince ourselves the other is less than human, less deserving, less worthy of love, less worthy of respect, always less than, always. Civility, though, assumes and affirms the worth of all people. The language of civility has no words for idiot, moron, libtard, redneck, hick, hilljack, wingnut, nutjob, lunatic, or elitist. Those words simply do not exist in the language of civility. They're only neighbors. And that's the starting point, the first point. And like all starting points, it is the most difficult lesson to learn. The language of civility is kind. so is less likely to be spoken at rallies, pickets, demonstrations, marches, Facebook, blogs, sit-ins, and sit-downs. Of course, it can be found at all those places, but I've noticed its presence is much rarer. The language of civility is more likely to be spoken and heard on front porches, in conversations, chats, at kitchen tables, meal sharing, barn raisings, coffee shops, classrooms, diners, break rooms, town halls, library, and for me in Danville, the Dairy Queen on a summer evening, watching the traffic go by and visiting with people I know. Isn't that where minds are changed anyway? In those informal places of gathering, no one goes on Facebook to have their minds changed. No one flips on Fox News or MSNBC to have their minds changed. The language of civility is kind. It listens tenderly. It shares kindly. It avoids rhetoric and exalts in reason. It turns the soil so the seed of truth can sprout. While the language of civility is kind, it is also committed always to moral clarity, and thus is courageous. It does not go along to get along. It loves people too much to mislead, deceive, or hoodwink. It rejects false flattery, hidden meaning, and does not believe that a nod is as good as a wink. It is forthright. Its highest aspiration is truth, clearly and compassionately spoken. Because it aspires to truth, it listens as thoughtfully as it speaks. It bears in mind always the rule of Oliver Cromwell, to think it possible that you may be mistaken. The lover of civility is wary of dogma, embraces reason, is committed to the ethical evolution of self and others, and is pleased by the double victory when right carries the day and all involved are cherished and honored. Next. The language of civility is genuinely interested in understanding the other person's position, even perhaps especially when it knows it does not agree with that position. Genuinely interested in understanding the other's position, it does not have to agree with that position, but it must strive to understand that position, so it listens carefully, deeply, thoughtfully. It concedes there might be value to a point of view that has not been fully appreciated. It realizes that people sometimes have very logical reasons to believe what they believe, even when we don't share those beliefs. Remember, beliefs are never formed in a vacuum. They are shaped by life experience, education, culture, religion, and family life, to name a few. We can never fully know the views of another until we understand the environment that gave birth to those views, which means taking a genuine interest in understanding the other person's perspective. Lastly, an important word about civil language and oppression. And I think this is especially timely in our day. It is never appropriate for those who are on top, those who have their knees squarely in the backs of those they're holding down, to insist their victims speak with civility. The oppressor does not get to determine the language of the oppressed, nor does the oppressor get to select the spokesperson for the oppressed. When Colin Kaepernick took a knee, it was not the moral right of white people to tell him what means of protest were acceptable and what means were not. It was our responsibility to take a genuine interest in understanding his position, to listen carefully, deeply, and thoughtfully, and then to act, but always to act in solidarity with the oppressed, in accordance with their voice and their vision. So here we are in summary. We must become bilingual, able to speak not only with those most like us, but those least like us. Our tendency is always to avoid those people. We must overcome that tendency. I routinely unfriend or block people on Facebook who are the very people I should be getting to know better. So we have to become bilingual. The language of civility asserts the worth of each person. The language of civility is kind, but it is also committed to moral clarity and is therefore courageous. The language of civility seeks to understand the position of the other person, and it is never appropriate for the oppressor to tell the oppressed how they must speak and what they must say. I look forward to being with all of you in the weeks ahead. I won't be speaking every time. I think I'm down to a third of the time now, maybe even a fourth. But I'm going to be here engaging in the conversation, and I look forward to that. We're now going to turn things over to the one who has hair and let him moderate our Q&A.
Thank you, Phil.
So one of the privileges of being the moderator is that you get to go first. And so I want to share a little story with you about uncivil dialogue in our uncivil times. And it happened to me about 3 years ago right now. It was the early spring of 2016, and of course we were 7 months away from an election. And we were up in northern Michigan in Boyne. We'd gone up there for late season skiing with our daughter, who happened to be on her spring break. And we were out to dinner one night, and after dinner, as I was walking out, I saw four white men about my age, a little bit younger, sitting in a booth. And I saw one of them wearing a t-shirt that had the words Hillary Clinton on it. And I thought, well, what do you know? In northern Michigan, there's a Hillary Clinton supporter. So I was just going to go up and crack a little joke about how I didn't expect to see anybody in northern Michigan who was supporting Hillary Clinton. But as I got closer to the booth, I realized that this t-shirt said Hillary for prison. And at that very moment, he saw the look in my eye, which was a look of surprise. And he said to me, "You thought I was a Hillary supporter, didn't you?" He then said, unprovoked, "I'm a born-again Christian. I've recently devoted my life to Jesus Christ, and I support Donald Trump because he's going to support us and protect us from all these immigrants and Muslims who are trying to destroy our country." Well, that's when I should have continued listening and stopped talking, but I couldn't resist. And I said, "Well, if you're so concerned about danger to our country, perhaps we should ban all the young white men from our country because they are mostly the ones who are killing people in mass shootings. We'd be a lot safer without young white men in our country." He then reached out and grabbed my left bicep, I think, and he said, "You look like you're in pretty good shape, but I don't think you're going to do very well out back against me and my three buddies." And then, once again, because I couldn't resist, I suggested to him that he read Jesus again. I couldn't believe it. And I know that the rest of you have had experiences like this. And it happens on Facebook all the time. It's the anonymity. people feel licensed to say things that they might never say to your face. And maybe the best thing that we could do is get rid of these things. Stop sending text messages and only have a conversation with someone if it's over a cup of hot coffee, where you can figure out who their family is. Talk to them about their children or their grandchildren or their hopes for our society as a whole. But that discussion is something that most of us don't really invest in much. And so, on the theme of Phil's talk tonight, civil dialogue in uncivil times, I encourage anyone to stand up and talk. We have very few rules here, other than to be civil, because it's one thing to talk about civility, it's another thing to practice it. And so my only instruction as moderator is to just be civil with each other. Sam, do we have a microphone that we're going to... Aha.
I'll be glad to bring the microphone to you.
Don't be shy. You're in a friendly place.
I am the despair of my friends because I talk to everybody. People in restaurants who I don't know. People in grocery stores who I don't know. If they have babies, of course I speak to them. But it's really interesting to see the reaction of people when you come up and say, oh, you have such an attractive shirt. I like your shirt. And they look at you like, well, does this gray-haired old lady dangerous? I'm not, truly. And when I leave them, I tell them, God bless them.
Good for you.
And God bless the family. But however, as you say, I've seen some with Trump shirts, and I've managed to keep my mouth shut. I do say hello, or if they have a child with them or something. I speak to children and old people. That's where I feel most comfortable.
It's a safe bet, usually.
I had a somewhat similar experience once. You're all familiar with the Forever stamp. Well, when those first came out, I happened to be at the post office, and I was standing behind two ladies who were at the stamp machine, and they were arguing back and forth which stamps they should get. And I, you know, unsolicited, I said, you know, you might consider those Forever stamps because they're going to be good even when the postage goes up. And they looked at me like I was a serial killer or from Mars or something. I think they thought I was trying to bamboozle them, but you know, I was just trying to be helpful. Apparently they had not heard of Forever stamps yet.
It's odd that it's almost as though we're all so isolated now, that we're not used to the normal intercourse of human beings dealing with each other. And some of the normal dialogue, I mean, the most innocent of circumstances where you're just trying to help somebody out is somehow perceived as something negative. Maybe the part of the breakdown is that we just don't spend enough time together.
No front porches.
No front porches, not enough of them.
Along those lines, some of us, I'm thinking about Joe Biden, who's whole life has been devoted to getting to know people, being friendly, and he's come under great criticism because of his inability, I guess, to touch people. I know, and I'm sure all of us do, know folks who are like that. They're touchers, I don't know where you draw the line, really, and
right.
Because some people are going to be offended, even though the intent is pure.
Right. Well, and the criteria that we use to judge people now, you know, my wife and I are lawyers here in town, and Betty does a lot more criminal defense work than I do, but people often ask, well, how can you do that? You know, how can you defend somebody who's committed a crime? And And I mean, of course, they forget first that we have a presumption of innocence in our society, thank God. But people make mistakes. It's not normally the totality of who they are. And so, you know, the basic notions of forgiveness that a lot of us just don't carry around, and how we judge people, and how harshly and quickly we judge others, and how we disqualify people so quickly as someone that we might consider having a friendship with or even a dialogue with, is maybe one of our first problems. We just need to listen. We just need to listen, which is something that we're hopefully starting tonight. Mary.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I find a smile and a hello or a hi to anybody makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of times, I mean, Sam just has bad luck because the nice people he encountered wanted to have nothing to do with him. But, you know, the person who's checking you out at the grocery store, do you strike up a conversation with him? Do you ask them about their kids? Do you just talk them about the events of the day? I happened to bump into some kid who was bagging my groceries at Kroger a few months ago, and he was pursuing his PhD in American literature, and next thing I knew, we were talking about Henry Miller, and it's like, well, we're just off to the races, you know, just because I happened to open my mouth and try to have a discussion with a human being.
And you had everybody behind you in line very angry.
Well, there was that part, yeah, because we're all in such a rush. We got to go, go, go. No time to slow down in America. Please, sir.
Well, along that line, I think I'm curious about, I see you still have your left arm. And I think I heard half the story. What happened?
My wife and daughter walked up to the table at that time, and Betty knows that I can open my mouth in ways that I should not. And she could hear the tone of the discussion, and it was exit stage left. So she saved me, because otherwise I would have been pummeled. I mean, let's be honest.
I was listening to you, Phil, and I was a public defender for a number of years, and I could always find something to like about my clients, and I could be civil to them. But I'm a long ways from being able and probably willing to be civil to a lot of the Trump supporters. It depends a lot on what they have to say, but some of it I just react to. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, the dynamic about the Trump supporters and the Trump voters is interesting to me, because many of the people who voted for Trump also voted for Barack Obama. I know many people who voted for Barack Obama in both elections in which he ran, who also voted for Donald Trump. And that is a mystery that confounds me until I begin to reflect upon the powerlessness that many people feel to affect change in our nation. And so somehow thought it prudent to elect a man who threatened to drain the swamp. I mean, they were taken on a ride, I think, but I understand well the frustration that could motivate some people to vote for Trump. It's not a frustration I share, but there are people I know and love who felt that deeply and who felt that voting for Donald Trump would be a corrective. And I must say that that when I look at America, when Trump was running, I do think a corrective was necessary. He has not offered the correction that I think people wanted. I thought the correction lay in the area of more
But I really struggle with my friends who call themselves Christians. Now, I can somewhat understand why they voted for Trump, but I'm shocked that he still has 40-some percent approval rating, because I thought most of them by now would have realized what they'd voted for.
Well, and I think in America, we should never underestimate the power of racism to gather a crowd. And I think that was evident in this race from the start, when in the announcement that he was running, that just spoke so unkindly, so falsely about immigrants. Yeah. So in American politics, I think it pays us never to discount the power of racism. I thought having a black president would change that. I think a lot of people did, and I think we were really mistaken.
Interesting. I want to weigh in on an issue that's kind of broken my heart, and that is the disparities you're talking about, the African Americans who take a knee and then get, you know, ostracized and told they're non-American, and the African Americans who've been shot and killed. And oddly, when I went to college, I got into Earlham College because I joined I became employed by the Upward Bound program. I was the only white tutor's aide in the Upward Bound program. And I fell in love with a black man who was also gay. I'm probably the only person that could do that. And so that didn't work out. But we were walking down the street, and about four young men jumped out of a car and tried to attack us, and I was ready to take them on. And he backed me up and talked them through it. And I'm just amazed that our country is also still not over racism. And I think that the reason for that is that several years ago, we stopped giving cost of living increases. We had a situation where people could go to the military and get free college. People in manufacturing positions were making equal pay, blacks and whites. And we started to have a very strong African-American middle class. I think if we'd kept going with that and we hadn't all of a sudden stopped cost of living raises, and we hadn't started to differentiate between, you know, like the poor became poorer. There was no way out of the ghetto because you couldn't get a job making $25 an hour putting a cog in a wheel anymore. In our state, our governor decided a brilliant idea that he would give bonuses to the best schools. Well, the best schools are in the highest tax bracket schools. That was Hamilton County. So you have the disintegration of the Indianapolis public schools and the shoring up of Carmel schools that don't need it. And that's, I really think that we've started to value money over justice and over fairness, and we've allowed a president to buy the presidency. So how do we talk about that? We not only talk to each other about that, but we need to also call our legislators when they do things like say, we're going to give teacher raises, and then they say, no, we're not going to do that this time because the teachers don't really want the raises. They want teacher aides in the classroom. That's just simply not true. The teachers need raises. You know, I'm kind of rambling, so I'm going to quit.
And you raised so many fundamental points about the cost. you know, and is Trump the problem, is Brexit the problem, or are they just symptoms of a problem that is much larger that we're not talking about, which
if
is...
If we all talked to our legislators, we would have told this Congress to stop him.
But we don't talk.
What?
We just read the paper, and we listen to the news, and we feel good that we listen to NPR because it makes us feel good. It's like we turn on our friend in the morning, and our friend's there. But how many go out and knock on doors to get people out to vote? How many sit down and talk about the issues? How many even know the name of their state senators? When's the last time you talked to one of them? When's the last time you talked to your congressperson? Have you done anything to try to influence government except the fact that 30% of you might have showed up to vote? I mean, it's no wonder these fools are running the asylum, because we do nothing to pull their chains. And so first causes are critical. You have to be able to talk like this woman can talk about the issues. How many people can even do that? Hopefully a lot of people here probably, but in our society, how many people can? And so part of the civil dialogue is we have to talk about the issues, and then we have to mobilize and affect change, or we're just going to sit around on a Sunday night, a nice old church, listen to Phil talk, and feel bad about ourselves.
I do write letters to them, and I just go on, and then I get these lovely little letters back.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
From staff.
Yes, and we appreciate your
Yield it.
Yesterday being the Martin Luther King assassination anniversary, that many years ago today, I found myself in Chicago with armed troops on the streets. And that is scary. And it happened so fast. And there was no uproar, no... In hindsight, there was no reason for it. Actually, it felt very comforting. But I think that we're at the point that if we end up trying to place folks, immigrants, in sanctuary cities, that you're liable to see the same kind of troop action. And believe me, you don't want to see troops around supporting the courthouse in Danville.
Hi, I'm Jeff. I have to remind myself when dealing or just interfacing with people that may not believe the same way I do, is that they don't believe that way because they just woke up one morning and love Trump and love everything about him. Everybody is a product of their entire life up to that point. And whether they got poor breaks or weren't loved or whatever the situation might be. And through the dialogue, we just have to keep that in mind and moderate our own discussion in trying to talk to others.
Hi, this is a question for Phil. What do we do? I mean, we're talking here, everyone here is open to dialogue and wants to have civil discourse. But it seems to me that's not necessarily something that can be attained, because the world seems to have changed so much that there are people who exist to be provocateurs. They want to be uncivil. They don't want the dialogue. And it seems like there's enough of them out there. My husband and I work at DePauw. And what was the name of that church that picketed? The West Baptist?
Yes. West Baptist.
Yeah, and they came out and they wanted to be provocative. And the smart thing to do would be to ignore them which didn't happen. So we had sort of a melee on campus. But if they want to be provocative and we ignore them, maybe we've stopped a fight from happening, but it's still two sides not listening to each other. So what do you do to have a civil conversation with someone who doesn't want to have a civil conversation?
I was thinking of Lincoln, Nebraska, about half a dozen years ago. I was there giving, talking to church, and Westboro Baptist showed up to pick it up. And I was so delighted because I just read a bumper sticker that said something about may you, the great honor of dying and having Westboro Baptist Church picking your funeral. I think there are, M. Scott Peck says the definition of evil is militant ignorance. And I think there are people in the world who are militantly ignorant and who delight in that. I don't believe in the devil. I do believe in evil. And I do believe there are people who are committed to militant ignorance. I hear them on talk radio. I see them on television. I see them in seats of power. But I think there is something to be said for the phrase, insofar as it depends upon me, I will be civil to all. So it isn't something we give to someone because they earn that. We are that way because that's who we are. But we will not stoop. Neither will we ignore militant ignorance. We'll address it. We'll speak forthrightly in its presence. We will not be cowed by it. But we will not stoop to it either. And that's the only way I know how to deal with that. And we all run into that these days. I'm amazed how often I hear this playing out. John Kerry, just last week, was taken to task by a legislator who had 2 degrees from MIT and was denigrating science to score political points against John Kerry. Now, what is that but militant ignorance? And so I think when we see that, we speak clearly about it. And, civil language doesn't mean we're soft. It means we carry ourselves with dignity and speak honestly and forthrightly about what needs to happen in this world. Remembering Cromwell's, remember that you might be mistaken. That seasoning of humility when we engage others, which I think is the real problem, that when that sense of humility is lost, watch out, because all kinds of bad things start happening then. I mean, I have family members who voted for Trump. And every time I get together with them, it is an exercise in diplomacy and But I loved them before I ever heard of Donald Trump. And I'm going to continue to love them. And I'm going to continue to tell them what I think. And I'll continue, because they're my brothers, to tease them about it as much as I can. To maintain a level of good humor with them about that. But I don't let it go
My name's Renee, and I'm thinking a lot about what Phil said about sort of civility being bilingual and that your first language is who you surround yourself with. And because I'm a teacher, it's, you know, I get to see that firsthand and interact with all of my students who, you know, might have only spent time with adults who think the same way and act the same way. I wanted to give a shout out to Mary Huber over there. I run a United Way funded after school tutoring program called Read Up. And I feel so fortunate that for the last 3 years, I've watched over 75 tutors interact with kids in our community. I think it's rare to have long opportunities for kids to interact with adults who are not family these days, because we are kind of closed off from each other and everyone is on their devices. And I think, you know, to the idea that civility is dead, I think needs to be out of our heads, because we all have an opportunity to interact with the next generation. And so I would just challenge you, if you feel, you know, disheartened by that, that it's not too late, and we have so many children who would love to interact with people other than their family. And I think that's about the only way we're gonna get those students to be bilingual.
I too am one of those extroverts that talks to all kinds of people. And occasionally I get to talk to somebody who's a Trump supporter, but the problem I have is that almost infallibly they get their facts from Fox News. And so we have different sets of facts. If we can't even agree on the facts, it's really hard to have a discussion. As I was thinking about this, it occurred to me maybe I need to talk about what's going on in their lives that makes them feel the way they do about some of these issues. So
we have a truth problem.
Knocked on hundreds, if not
I know you're keeping an eye on the clock, so I've got two for sure. So let me know when I need to.
So I'll be quick. So I guess continuing then along with what Melissa was saying, something I was thinking. Obviously, I'm white. I live here in Hendricks County. I'm a mother. I'm kind of Catholic. and I think that people in my experience, not just Hendricks County, but other places I've lived, just assume because of those things that that we do speak the same language like you're referring to. So, you know, I've had people make different comments, whether it's political or racist or, you know, take your pick, and assume that I'm on their side because of what little they know about me. And those are the small opportunities I try to take to gently show a different perspective or try to give somebody an idea, just something else, just another idea to chew on. And that can be very difficult sometimes, you know, depending on what type of setting you're in. If there's a lot of other people, it takes a lot of courage, and sometimes I'm not that courageous. Sometimes I just kind of sit back and let it play out. But I guess I just throw that out there. I mean, I think sometimes there are small opportunities we can take when it's, especially when it's just one-on-one or in a small group and we have differing opinions to try to present other points of view that a lot of people in Hendricks County don't seem to even be aware of. So.
Phil talked about the importance of speaking with moral clarity, and I think that's absolutely necessary, but I also think it presents a huge risk. And the risk is this: when we feel we're speaking with moral clarity, we are speaking emotionally. It is very difficult, in my mind at least, to be speaking about what I feel is morally right and to do so in a way that does not turn off the other person. If I think I am right, and I'm speaking to them, it implies that they are wrong. And so I'm not saying that we not speak with moral clarity, but instead I'm saying that maybe we need to do more of what he also said, which is to listen very carefully first. I used to work for what is now Duke Energy, and so did Phil, and that's where I first met him and so forth. But one of the things they taught us in customer service was when you had an angry customer or something like that, you first listen. And you repeat back to them what they have said so that they know that you have heard them. I understand you. I see why you're upset about this. Allow them to know that you have some shared feeling, passion, understanding with them. And then perhaps move on to speaking with moral clarity. But even then, I think it's much more helpful, speaking of civil dialogue, to ask questions rather than pronounce, to invite the other person to explore rather than. And I have a really hard time with that, so here I am preaching to you about doing it. But nonetheless, I think this idea that we stand on higher ground is a real risk to convincing anybody to think like us. And so I would just offer that word of caution.
My friend Jim Mulholland, who is, I've known now for close to 30 years, is masterful at that. I've seen this guy walk into rooms where everybody was opposed to what he was going to say, and he knew it. And by the end of the evening, he had people standing and applauding. And it was because he has this remarkable gift that whoever he speaks to feels genuinely heard and cared for. And it creates an environment then people can really learn and grow. And I've never seen anyone with the gift that he has for that. And you'll all get to experience that when Jim comes and speaks. Our speaker next session, we're meeting the second and fourth Sunday evenings. Bring a friend. Ideally, bring a friend who disagrees with you. Bill will be speaking on the problem
is our privilege to be together tonight.